So you have a itinerary and your love overlanding. You have plans to do it big on the trails and some super glamping. One idea, deep news and reviews, a podcast the first rate and here just for you. You don't have to think about it, join us and be about it. Something interesting we want to hear about it. Come on, let's talk about it. Welcome to Waypoint Overland's Random Waypoints Podcast.
Sponsored by Midland. Communication for every adventure. The industry leader in radio communication technology and innovation for over 50 years. Sponsored by MyMedic. Sponsored by Tembo Tusk. Sponsored by Shower Pouch. Sponsored by DeMoss Collective, mission built and made for mobility. Sponsored by BrewTrek. Sponsored by Hard Impact Designs.
Always remember, the opinion you follow should be your own. Just consider the things stated here to be a second opinion from a complete stranger online.
What's up, Candy?
Hey, how's it going? How's the weather where you're at?
The weather is beautiful right now. It's been very hot.
Yeah.
But we're getting a little respite now. It's in the upper 70s.
Okay.
So it's a warm day, but it's not a hot day.
Okay. It's really, it's not great here. Welcome to monsoon season in the desert. So it's been raining on and off. And we have a fire coming in from the south end of California. It just jumped over into Nevada here. I think yesterday is what they're saying, down in the Mojave Preserve. So if you're planning on going to the Mojave Preserve, maybe skip it for a while, because I don't know that they're going to be open.
I never asked you. We hung out last weekend. In Toledo, Oregon, at the Holy Toledo. Was that your first event that of Josiah's that you attended?
Yeah, it was. I was very nervous about it too, I will admit.
I was going to say why. I know why.
Yeah.
So tell me what you thought. Seriously, give me your honest opinion of the event.
So there were a few things that surprised me about the event. It was smaller than I expected it to be. The crowd, age-wise, was a lot more mixed than I expected it to be, which was a very pleasant surprise. The entertainment was great. Thoroughly enjoyed that. They had great entertainment. And I like that he brought in comedians. So before it got dark and before the lasers went on and things like that, he had he had comedians up on stage, you know, doing their thing. And then, after that, we rolled into the music for the evening, which was super fun. They were very talented. I enjoyed them tremendously. The food was amazing. I liked that it was a food event because, you know, I'm a foodie. I like to eat a lot. And what else? Oh, the Olympics were very interesting too. The overlanding Olympics. Oh my gosh. I tell you what, that was some funny stuff. Thoroughly enjoyed it. I liked the diversity. So, I mean, I thought it was a lot of fun and I would enjoy going to another one of his events.
So you mentioned the food. I was very fortunate. I had two ladies cooking for me all weekend.
Yeah, well, you know, you provided us some good ingredients, so thank you for that.
So those listening who don't know the joke, Candy was one of those two ladies. I was very fortunate to have you and Sheila, Mama Got Wheels, cooking some delicious, delicious meals the whole weekend. I want to thank you. I appreciate it.
Aw, thank you. You're welcome. Anytime. Anytime, so yeah. Mama also got margaritas too, man. She's got that down.
Oh yeah, the hibiscus margaritas. Yeah. I will never forget those. That is the bar for margaritas now.
Well, and it was funny too because it happened just out of chance, because I had those hibiscus flowers because I make tea. So I had them and I was making sun tea with it. That's how it came up. I was making sun tea with some, and she's like, oh, we can infuse the tequila. And I'm like, hey, you want some? Here you go. And it was just a happy accident. So it just kind of all worked out, which is which is pretty great. But yeah, we definitely need more of that. And I think that maybe next time, this is what I'm going to suggest to her, actually, is that we bring more things to infuse. More infusion.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
We need more of that.
And I'll be your test dummy.
I will tell you, I'm not a big margarita drinker, but I like hers. And that just happened to be really, that was just extra. So I liked it.
So we cooked a lot of food for a lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
And in order to do that, we had to use a bunch of stoves. So I took advantage of the opportunity to do kind of a little stove test.
Yeah.
We had the Snow Peak burner.
Mm-hmm.
We had the Jetboil Genesis double burner.
Mm-hmm.
We had one of those ones where you put the, what was the one that was right on top of the fuel canister?
Oh, MSR. That was an MSR one.
They call it a fire or something.
Something like that. Yeah. It was, I think they call it the, oh goodness, I own the thing too.
It's basically the same as the Snow Peak I gave you, basically.
Yeah, it is. It's the same. It's just a little pocket size MSR stove, and that's really great. You know what, though? We had so many people, and none of us carry around big pots and pans, okay? So we had to have a bunch of little things going on all at the same time to make this happen, because we even had the adventure scuttle out, too. Because, you know, typically I travel solo, so I cook for like one, maybe two people, you know, sometimes, you know, three, but that was a lot of people.
You've cooked for three a few times that I know of.
Yes.
And your scuttle was more than enough. You have the little one, but it was more than enough. You definitely were able to get the job done.
Oh, yeah.
Now, disclosure.
If
people skip through the sponsor segment of this podcast, then they're probably not aware that one of my sponsors is Timbo Tusk. So keep that in mind, ladies and gentlemen. But we're going to discuss all of these stoves. What did you think? Give me your honest opinion. Which one did you like? Which one you didn't like? Why do you like it?
I will tell you. So the one that I was most surprised at, I was most disappointed in. So let's go with that one, was the Snow Peak. So cute, so compact, so handy, and it was butane. So it was a completely different fuel. And I was really excited to get to try it out, because I'd never even seen that particular model before. And I own the Baja one, the Baja stove that they have in their single burner. So this new one that you brought out was really compact, really cool. And I thought, oh man, if it works similarly, then, you know, that might be a home run. I found that the flame was difficult to regulate. It was a very concentrated flame, and it was very, very exposed. So whenever you open it up, there's no wind protection or anything. Mm-hmm. So I found those things to be disappointing whenever I used that one, although it is cute, it is compact, and it is very well made. It's a really well made product.
I agree. If MacGyver had a stove, this would be his stove.
That's a good way.
It's just like a small tube, but when you open it up, you've got a full blown stove. Actually, I would say the burner, not the actual burner, but the what you set your pot on, mm-hmm. is larger than a lot of home stoves. That's the only selling point for it to me, is if you have 12-inch plus dishes, it's perfect for that. It'll hold large cookware very easily.
Mm-hmm.
But everything else that you said, I agree with totally.
Okay.
So what else do we have? We had the, what's the next one you want to talk about?
Oh gosh, that little jet boil, that orange jet boil you had, that dual burner. What's the name of that one?
Jet Boil Genesis.
Okay. That one was my favorite. I'm just going to cut right to the chase and say that one was my favorite out of all of them that we tried out, because it was still compact. Okay. But you open it up and you have two burners there. Very nice. They're ample size. I will say, though, something that you actually pointed out to me, which I didn't even realize until you were trying to make coffee. We were trying to make coffee on it, and the coffee, the grates, the coffee pot would sit on were too far apart for it to rest on easily, which I was very surprised. And this is a standard size coffee pot. This is not weird. This is not unusual. It's not something special, but it just didn't. It didn't fit. It was too small because the grates were just too far apart. But the rest of it, though, the efficiency, the way that it, the way that you can regulate your burner, I really like that. It is a little bit more on the pricey side, but I believe with this particular product, you may get what you pay for with it because it is also very well made. And we did a lot of really great food on that. Once we discovered it, that was primarily what we stuck with, actually, for the rest of the weekend. Yes. So yeah, that one was my favorite. And of course, you know,
the little small flaw that you mentioned is a big flaw to me because I'm a coffee person in the morning. And if I decide to go with the Genesis, it requires me to have a secondary flame of some sort for boiling water and making coffee.
Yeah.
If the grates were able to allow me to put a percolator or a kettle on it, I'd rate that thing a 10.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of size that it, the amount of space that it uses up, very little. You can just toss that thing anywhere and you've got a full-blown two burner.
Yes.
And I think it really shined when we were cooking because you were cooking a lot of delicate fishes and sauces and things like that where flame is a big deal. Being able to control that flame is a huge deal. That can make a difference between you scorching something. And it did a great job. We made toast with that thing, remember?
I do, yes. And plus, we were cooking on cast iron, too. And the cast iron, you know, with that fish and stuff like you're talking about and those sauces and things, it could have burnt straight to the bottom of that if you didn't have the flame just right. So, yeah, because you also have to mention, you know, the cookware, too. It just complemented it all very well. And they were full size. They're huge. These are huge pots and pans. And it fit beautifully next to one another working at the same time. You and I were each using a burner standing next to each other cooking on this thing. And we were very comfortable.
Very comfortable. Yes.
Yeah. I didn't get your way. You didn't get my way. It was fine. So yeah.
We're missing one. Oh, so the MSR. What do you think of the MSR?
The pocket
rocket. It's almost
rocket.
Unfair for it to be pocket rocket.
That's yes. It. It's the pocket rocket. So I will say that I carry my pocket rocket with me all over the place, as well as the new Snow Peak that you gave me too. And I actually used it in one of my classes because one of the classes that I teach at Expo is actually called Modular Overlanding. And I actually pull out these little stoves and I bring up to people, I say, if you don't want to carry a huge stove, carry these little guys right here, you know, and you can have as many burners as you need. So I carry, you know, one, now I carry two, and now I have a two burner stove with me all the time, which is very convenient. So.
And they're small that you can just throw it in your glove compartment. It's not something you have to think about.
I really like mine. There's nothing that I don't like about my pocket rocket, to be honest. And, before I had my Scottle, I was looking to make an upgrade to a stove to cook for more than one person. At the time, because all I carried with me since 2017, when I bought it, was that it went to the Arctic Circle with me. I can throw it in my backpack and take it with me. I have a 5-inch cast iron skillet that I use on top of there, and it fits perfectly. And I make eggs on it. I sear meats and things on it. It just works really, really well. And that accompanied with my Snow Peak Titanium 900 that I carry. I make soups and stews and things like that in there too. So, you know, I use it for a lot of different things. So I'm a big, big fan of those tiny little stoves. So whenever you gave me the Snow Peak one, I was super excited. You're like, yeah, this is just a thing you can throw in. And I'm like, yeah, I love it. It's great. It's perfect. So it goes everywhere. So yeah, I'm a big fan of those pocket stoves.
Never would be my main stove. But when, you know, we party a lot, we cook a lot, we hang out a lot. And it's always good to be able to just pull out another burner.
Yep. Very convenient. So do we want to talk about how the Adventure Scuttle performed with all of these too?
Oh yeah, that was the next thing out of my mouth. So okay. go right for it. Yes.
Okay. So I've only had mine for less than a year. I bought it last year at whenever I was in Colorado at Mountain West, Overland Expo Mountain West. So I've had it for less than a year. So this whole year I've been in the getting to know you phase of my Adventure Scuttle, right? But I've literally taken it everywhere that I've gone. So I will admit I was a little skeptical about it at first, but I've grown to really, really like it. They say you season it like cast iron because I'm a big cast iron fan. Even at home, that's what I cook on is cast iron. So this is steel. So it was something I thought maybe I had to get used to. Nope. Not at all. I just rolled right into it from the cast iron. I clean it the same way. I cook on it very similarly. I will say it cools off a lot faster, which I really, really like. So it's cool in no time. So I can clean it. I can put it in its little bag and put it away and it's done. And I'm done for the evening cleaning up. So that part I really like too. So as far as like boiling water and stuff in the mornings, so the burner is very interesting. It is not permanently attached to the stove itself or to the scuttle plate. It slides in and out. So if I just want to use that little burner head for coffee or something like that, it's very convenient to do that. And I do it all the time. So I'm a big fan of the Adventure Scuttle in particular because of its compact size.
Well, one thing I noticed when we were using all of these stoves was it was the first one cleaned and put away.
Because it was the first one cool. it was the first one cooled off enough to do that. And it's so cute.
But it was, you just cleaned the top and yeah. You were pretty much done. Mm-hmm. Everything else, we had to pull out grates and clean inside them. Plus, there was a dish that needed to, or I'm sorry, cookware that needed to be cleaned in addition to that.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, there are days that I just eat off the top of the scuttle whenever I'm making breakfast or something. And, you know, because I keep mine clean all the time. I don't leave it dirty ever. So whenever I make my eggs and bacon and potatoes or something like that in the morning, I'll do it in one dish all at the same time. And I just stand there and I will eat right off the top of it like plates. Like an animal, I guess, no, but it works well. Do
that. I do that all the time with the bigger, you know, I got the bigger one.
I do
that all the time. So I end up, the only thing I need to clean is whatever I was flipping my food with, a fork in the top of my scuttle.
Yeah.
And I'm done. And depending upon when I'm cooking, I can literally lean my scuttle over and just kind of scrape it off and I'm done.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm a big fan of my little Adventure Scuttle. That's no joke. Cause I, of course I'm not sponsored at all by anybody. So I'm actually speaking just, you know, because I really, really like it. So I do, I'm a big fan of it and I actually have no regrets at all with it, except I'm really liking the table that, that they've got. Jerry, if you're listening.
Now, you know, I liked the table. I asked him for the table.
Okay.
But I like it more now that I have it.
Okay.
It was just, being honest, it was just a nice table to me. It was mm-hmm. It was nothing special about it. I just wanted a good table. It looked like it was a good table.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so many features to it once you actually have it. And I think I've shown you, you know, the adjustable legs. Like I can sit down and it can be like a coffee table. I can raise it up. And my particular table has the accessory where you can remove a portion of the table and it becomes a sink.
I love that.
I love that too, because my issue is always the cleaning part of cooking.
Yeah.
It's so convenient to have it right there at that height. I love it.
Well, and there's a lot of other different things you can do too with that little sink. You can use it whenever you're cutting and chopping. You can use that little sink as for your scraps off to the side mm-hmm. just to get them out of the way and then dump it in the garbage can later. You know, I've only used your table one time and I really, really liked it. So yeah, there's a lot of good things you could do with that table. And I really dig it, especially the accessory part with the sink. That's the one I like.
If I were going to describe it to somebody, I think I would call it like, that's an overland table. And what I mean is, it's really built tough.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not worried about a year from now having to get that table replaced. It's very functional.
Yeah.
It's built like a brick. And the top is bamboo. Mm-hmm. So it looks good to the eye, but I'm not worried about bacteria or anything like that. As long as I once in a blue moon, you know, put some oil on it or something, I'm good to go with that. So I love my table. I love it more now than when I asked for it.
Well, it seems super sturdy too.
Oh, it's very sturdy.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about getting, you know, you can get another, I don't know what you call it, but there's an accessory where you have a lower table up under it. You know what I'm talking about?
I do. It's called a, someone's yelling at the screen right now. You know, they are saying it's this. nesting tables.
Yes. I'm thinking about getting that. Just because we be doing so much cooking, it just makes sense for me to get that additional part.
Well, and it's so you've got basically end up with this like this L-shaped kitchen area once you're all said and done. And you have got the, you know, the big sexy beast, Scottle, the, you know, the big boy. And so you've got that sucker sitting over there in one area. And then you've got the big L-shaped kitchen, man, you are good to go. And then I was really impressed with how small it folds up.
Yes.
I was very impressed with that.
And something most people don't care about, but I pay attention to in all the things I buy, he gives you a very nice case to hold for it in.
That's a big deal.
Matter of fact, everything he makes, he is taking the time to make a really good case, because my Scottle is like a really nice case.
Was that in conjunction with another company?
Originally, it was Blue Ridge Overland. I don't know if they still make the bag or not.
Okay.
But I know originally it was Blue Ridge or.
That's Overland. What I thought. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah. Well, it is a great bag. And I think it's important to have a carrying bag, because it keeps the tabletop from getting scratched, scuffed, dirty. It keeps your surface sanitary. I'm a very clean person. I'm big on cleanliness. Oh, yes.
Cleanest Scottle I have ever seen in my life, people.
Well, and I took my time, and I actually cleaned yours too one day, because I saw it. I was like, okay, well, before I cook on this bad boy, it needs a little bit of a cleaning, because we had just had lunch that day and you were letting it cool off and all that good stuff. And that's fine. And then we were going to use it for dinner, and I just had to give it a little quick, you know, clean. So, but no, it cleans up beautifully and quickly too.
One last thing about the bags.
Yeah.
Another thing I have to give Jerry credit for is most companies, if they do give you a nice bag, it fits so perfectly that you have to put everything perfectly to fit it in, and they barely fit. And if you have any extra accessories, they won't fit into the bag. That's not the case with the bags that Jerry makes for them. Because like with my Scottle, I keep 2 pound fuel bottles. Mm-hmm. I have the long hose so I can attach it to a 20 pound.
Okay.
I've got all my cooking utensils. When I pull that bag out, all I need is food.
Right.
And same thing with my fireplace. There's room for gloves and stuff. With the table, there's room for the additional accessories. I don't know about the adventure Scottle, but I know everything that I just mentioned. There's room for all the other things that you need to go with it.
So it's the same with the Adventure Scottle. In fact, what I put in mine is I've got the lid, and I just recently got the wind deal on there. It's a protector from wind. Oh yeah, that works really, really well. And it looks nice too. It's nice and contoured, so it matches, you know, the base of the Scottle really well. So I really like that. But 100% of that all fits into the bag, like you mentioned. And I carry the big you know, the big fuel canister. I put it at the bottom. I zip it up, just like you said. It's very convenient. I definitely appreciate that as well, because I don't have to, you know, mess around with a whole bunch of other stuff.
So tell me a little bit about the guard. I'm only going by what I see. It appears like that's probably the best guard out of the two Scottles. It looks like you could stand in the middle of a windstorm and wind can't get to that fire. Now, tell me if that's different. I don't know. It just looks good.
It looks really, really good. And I think, you know, I've been in some pretty windy scenarios with it, and it works really well. It protects the flame really well. And even if it's not windy, it helps concentrate the heat, you know, under there. So whether it's windy or not, I've been using it all the time now because I find that it makes a difference. But yeah, I and as far as looks goes, it looks really good. It looks, because I've seen the one on the bigger one, and it's more like a box, I guess, is how I would describe it. This is more artistic. Jerry got a little bit more artistic with this one, I think. It matches the bottom contour there, and then, you know, underneath, so you know exactly how it's supposed to go on. And then you've got the straight ends and all that, and it clips nice, you know, very nicely together. Oh no, it looks good. It looks really, really sharp.
It's got racing car lines.
It does. It's got style. So it's got itself a little bit of style to it now, and I really like that.
So 1 through 4, I think we said four different stoves. 1 through 4.
1 through 4, how would we rank them? Number one would be the little orange guy for me. I like him a lot. Because it's got just
Jetboil Genesis.
The Jetboil Genesis, thank you, sir. I really like that one a lot, just because it's got the two stoves and all the positive features that we talked about. Number two is my Adventure Scottle. Like, I really, really like my Adventure Scottle. Number three would be the MSR Pocket Rockets. I really like that a lot. And then, of course, at the bottom, what we talked about is the Snow Peak.
And I'm looking up the name of the stove because Snow Peak makes so many stoves. I want everybody to know what we're talking about.
Oh, yeah.
It's called the Home and Camp Burner. And the reason why they call it the Home and Camp Burner is it was designed, you know, in Japan, a lot of people have very little cooking space. So people literally use this in their homes, and then they put it, you know, on a shelf.
A lot I can of see how it would work really
actually,
well.
Yeah, a lot of people live in apartments, and a lot of those apartments don't actually have gas lines or anything for earthquakes and typhoons and stuff like that. Yeah. You know, I geek out on the Snow Peak stuff.
I know you do. You're a big fan, which is why I was so surprised that neither one of us, we were kind of on the same page when we talked about the stove. We were both like, oh, man, that's a bummer.
But I had to be truthful. So, folks, this is a good example. Yeah. I was heavily biased toward the Snow Peak.
Yeah.
But I'm going to always be honest. It rated last for me.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and you were super excited too whenever you brought it out too. You're like, and I said, what is this? Because it had the neat nylon case that it was in, which was so nice. And then it was nice and compact. I was like, this is so cool. So I was super excited to try it. And then I was bummed. So
my rating is exactly the same. I've got the Scottle first, the Jetboil Genesis second. I have the Pocket Rocket third, and I have the Snow Peak last.
Okay.
And you might be like, why would I have the Pocket Rocket above the Pocket Rocket doesn't have any limitations, and they're both supposed to be something compact. I think the Pocket Rocket complies to what its purpose is supposed to be more than the Snow Peak.
Okay. You know, I was really surprised with the Snow Peak at its weight, because it was much heavier than it looks like it should be. Its size tells me this is going to be ultra light. This is going to be super lightweight. You can throw it in your backpack and have this full size stove. You pick it up and you touch it and you're like, wow, this is a lot heavier than I expected. So a backpacker's not going to want to throw that in their, you know, on their back and go. It's just too heavy.
Oh, no. It's called the home and camp. This should have said home and car camp. So since we're talking about camping, I want to cover some of the celestial and astrological events that are going on during the course of the rest of the year. Usually Mike is with me, and we periodically cover some of the, you know, things that you can see in the sky when you're out camping or some, and we like to tell you in advance. So maybe you can plan to see some of these things.
Yeah. Okay. And, so what's this? This is the last day of July, isn't it?
Yep. 7/31/23.
All right. So we're looking at, starting August.
So one of the things I want people to look out for is something that's already occurring. It's from July 17th to August 24th. If you want to see a meteor shower, the ones that you see in comic books, the ones that you see in movies, if you want to see a real big, beautiful meteor shower, you want to see the Perseid meteor shower, which is going on currently.
Mm-hmm.
And the peak rate of meteors is around August 13th. So you've got a couple of weeks to make plans.
Now, is that going to be, so let me ask you then, whenever, say I want to go and see this, where would you recommend that we go? Is it better in the east side of the country, on the west side of the country? Does it matter at all?
Okay. From my understanding, my limited knowledge, it doesn't matter which side you're on, but the west side, if it's even Steven, the west side is always going to be better. You have more dark sky parks. You have more dark sky area. You have more open area, BLM, private land, blah, 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 blah.
Yep.
So your opportunities to, because we're talking about camping, we're talking about overlanding.
Yeah.
If you want to get away from people, if you want limited light pollution so you can have the best view.
Yeah.
West side. All day.
That's what I would say. I would agree with you on that. The West Coast is a lot better to view all that stuff, particularly in our deserts. Our deserts are amazing. One of the dark sky parks is the Great Basin National Park in Northern Nevada. And that's supposed to be really, really great. And I could see that being a great location to hit up for camping during that time to see that event.
And whether you camp or just drive and park there, Death Valley in the middle of the night, just look up. It's one of the most beautiful places to see the sky.
Yeah.
It's easily accessible because it's a national park. You don't have to get off the roads. You don't have to get on the trails. Just go to Death Valley, park your car, and look up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you want
to. Yeah, and you're not going to get cold there either. You don't need to bring a puffy jacket.
And another suggestion, which is right outside of Death Valley, is Rhyolite. The town of Rhyolite.
Oh, that ghost, that funky ghost town. Yeah, that's a great spot.
No light pollution. And the meteors should provide enough light that the buildings and the artwork should have nice shadows. So it would be a very unique, beautiful place to see those type of things.
Yeah, that's right there. It's that's very accessible right there from Death Valley, too. So yeah, that's a someplace that I think would be, that's a great suggestion.
Yeah. You know, Vic, Brooklyn born.
Yeah.
Yeah. The first trip he ever went cross country, I took him on and I took him to Death Valley, and he thanks me all the time for taking him to Death Valley. We just literally just sat on our cars and just looked up like kids at the sky for about an hour.
Oh, yeah. Mojave Preserve is in this area, too. It's on fire right now, though. But maybe if they get it out, that's another great spot that's going to be dark sky friendly.
And if you do, I would try to do central Mojave, because when you get to either end, the light pollution increases. I mean, you're still in the desert, so I'm not talking about like real light pollution. But the center of the Mojave is the best place.
like around the Kelso Dunes area. Is that what you're talking about?
Exactly.
Yeah. That's a really cool spot, especially at night with the moonlight on the top of the dunes. You actually see the spine of the dunes. Mm-hmm. That's a really neat spot. So yeah, I could see how the meteor shower would be really great from there too.
Funny you mentioned Kelso.
Yeah.
I hear that they're talking about opening back up the train station.
Really?
Which I'm like, that should happen no matter what. It should have never closed. I understand it closed for COVID.
Yeah.
But it should be up and running.
Yeah, I agree with that. They had a really nice museum in there too.
A museum and a restaurant.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about the restaurant. And
it's that original. Right. You sit at a bar. There's no other seating.
Counter service.
But it's a beauty. That's the original bar. That's the original wood and everything.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a beautiful building. Mm-hmm. And it's got a lot of great historic value to it. And they should open that up again. I hope they do soon.
I agree. So some people are going to say, well, 2 weeks, it's not enough time for me to make plans for the perceived meteor shower.
Okay.
But there's always something going on in the sky. If you do a little research, there's been stuff going on all year. And I just wanted to cover some of the things that are left this year that might be interesting for people to check out.
Are we going to mention the event that's going on around one of them?
Absolutely. Moonlight. Okay.
Yeah, moon landing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay. So let's start with that.
Okay. That's another Josiah event. Holy Toledo. So after getting the one under my belt, I would really like to go to moon landing. I hope to be able to make it. So we'll see. A lot of it hinges for me personally, because I want to be there, but it hinges on my new build being done and being back at the house. Because if I go to moon landing, I'm actually going to bring it. I'm going to bring it to moon landing because it'll be done.
So tell everybody, what is the connection between the moon landing and what we're talking about right now?
So it's on October 14th is the annular solar eclipse is what it is. It's supposed to be most visible out here in the West. So this event that's coming up is actually based in New Mexico. Just south of, I think it's, is it Grants? So it's just outside, it's just south of Grants in New Mexico there. So,
it's called Skyview, New Mexico.
Oh, that's the name of the town?
No, where the event is. It's right outside the town that you just mentioned. You literally,
okay, cool.
You can walk from the town to it. It's that they're contiguous.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So anyway, it's going to be great for viewing this event, which of course is during the day. It's not at night. This is actually during the daylight hours. But yeah, I think that's going to be another fun thing to do.
So just so I can get the information clear to people, we're discussing an event thrown by the same people who threw Holy Toledo, which we were just talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. It's called Moon Landing 2, and it's a nomad overlanding van life and solar eclipse festival. It's October 12th through 14th, and it's in Skyview, New Mexico. Now, if you're curious about the specifics about the particular solar eclipse, it's not a total eclipse. There's no total eclipse this year. But it's as close as you're going to get. This is a partial eclipse, and it'll be visible across the U.S. Even better, a stretch from southern Oregon through Nevada and into southern Texas will see a ring of fire during the eclipse. So they line up just perfectly where the sun will look like it's a ring of fire.
Wow.
And the route that I just told you, that's called the I can't think of the proper name now, but there's a path that it follows. And if you're along that path, you get the perfect alignment of them from your viewpoint. What's the word for it?
Oh, man.
Total something.
Let's see. I'm actually trying to look it up here.
But anyway, when there's a solar eclipse, it's basically the alignment of the moon with the sun, and the moon mm-hmm. is covering the sun. But in order for that, you to get that perfect alignment of the two covering each other, you need to be along the path of totality. That's what it's called.
I've never even heard that term before. So
I talked myself into remembering it. It's called the path of totality. So if you want to be in line with the best alignment of the two stars, you want to be somewhere through Southern Oregon, through Nevada, and into Southern Texas. That'll give you the best views.
Mm-hmm.
And New Mexico. I don't know how I forgot to say that, where the actual moon landing event will be.
Mm-hmm.
So you won't just be somewhere in the dark on this occasion. You will be in one of the prime spots in the whole United States to witness mm-hmm. this.
Yeah.
Secondly, it's a dark sky park. So you will be in one of the most darkest places in the whole United States with the least amount of light pollution in the whole United States. So
plus the landscaping. So the landscaping too in New Mexico is pretty cool too. It kind of resembles the moon a little bit. Mm-hmm. I mean, whenever you look at it with all the plateaus and all that stuff, it's kind of like a moon landing there too.
And from what everybody's telling me, this is the one that you want to be at.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're going to have it every year. But when I say be there, I don't mean just you should go to one time. I'm saying out of all of them, this year in particular is one of the most important ones to go to, because you'll be in the path of totality and be able to see the ring of fire during the solar eclipse. So I highly recommend this. If you're going, we're going to see each other. I know Mike is in the same situation. He's saying he'll be going if his rig is a long schedule. So mm-hmm. hopefully I'll see you guys there. Same thing. I'm working on my rig too, but I'm pretty sure I'll be ready to go by that time.
Yeah. How's your build coming along?
Waiting on my tires. Supposed to get those put on. I have my new fridge and stove slide. All new accessories from Blue Ridge Overland Gear.
Nice. They make great stuff.
I have a knife company. I want to wait till it actually gets here. I have a knife company that's given me a set of cooking knives. So that's all I want to say about that one.
Gotcha.
And I've got a few other things that I'm waiting out as far as sponsors. I don't want to say their names until I actually get their products in my hand. But if half of them come through, I've got a pretty nice bill coming up.
I can't wait to see it.
And if you've noticed, I haven't said what rig, what kind of vehicle it is yet, because
nope.
I'm waiting for my my vanity plate to come and my tires to be installed. So once I have my new tires on and my vanity plate, that's when I'll start showing what I'm doing with it.
Cool. That'll be exciting.
Otherwise, it's just a regular old truck.
Right. I hear you. Yeah, I haven't said a whole lot about mine either, and I don't plan on it until later.
Oh, I get it.
Yeah.
You want to go, pow!
That's right. Whammy!
I want to talk about, last week we were having a discussion about, there's been like a bunch of bear attacks.
Oh, man.
Through the United States.
Yes.
Five so far. In like a 2.5 month period. That's crazy.
Yeah, that's a lot.
And we were talking about bear safety and not being alone or anything like that. And I made a joke about, you know, I live in bear country and we have cougars. Well, guess what happens this weekend?
No way.
An 8-year-old camper survived being attacked by a cougar at Washington's Olympic National Park in Washington.
Wow.
That's just a few hours from me.
Yeah.
The ironic thing about it is, if you know anything about predatorial cats, is once they've caught their prey, they usually defend it. Mm. So the mother yelled at the cougar and it ran off.
That's so very lucky.
Very lucky.
Yeah, very lucky.
Something like that, they bite down harder and they pull away. So very lucky. Kid is pretty much uninjured considering, I mean, they got messed up, but not that bad considering they're 8 years old and it was a cougar.
Yeah, that's yeah, that kid got very, very lucky. I live in mountain lion territory. I live in big cat territory, and we have around our property, because we're surrounded by BLM land, we've got motion cameras, and we've got night vision cameras, and occasionally we'll actually catch a mountain lion on the exterior of our fence line, because we do have animals that they like to hunt, and they've actually been known to jump into people's yards and attack their horses and things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I have a resident bobcat who comes in my yard frequently. He's great for pest control. I like mm-hmm. Bob. I met him on my front patio for the first time, I think it was last year. And I'm like, what are you doing? And he just looked at me like, oh my goodness, and ran off. He's big though. Bob's big. But I've met Bob a few times since in the yard. So I like having him around. He's pretty cool.
So I want to pose this question.
Mm-hmm.
I just mentioned like land animals. There's been a lot of shark encounters in the past month. Lots of shark encounters, both on the east and the west coast of the United States.
Okay.
And I haven't bothered to research if it's even further, like in some other places, but we've had a lot of shark attacks. So my question is, what is going on? Animals are really pissed off or something.
So recently, in the last couple of days, the big joke in Florida has been, so you saw this movie about Cocaine Bear, right? Well, Florida, we decided, because I'm originally, that's where I'm from, that's my home state. We decided, yeah, we'll see your Cocaine Bear and give you cocaine sharks. Because literally, this has come out on the news now about the sharks that are eating cocaine that have been dumped off the Florida coast. So they're probably high, looking for a snack, getting the munchies. Here we go. Looking for something. So
I just read that. That is crazy.
I know. I thought it was nuts too. I'm like, no, this can't be real. And it is. It's a thing. I can't even believe it. Craziness.
Yeah. The article I read, they like interviewed people and they were like, oh yeah, cocaine. Lots of it ends up on the beach all the time.
Well, they're dumped by pirates who are being chased by the Coast Guard. That's why. So they dump money. It's true. They dump they dump their drugs and they dump cash, and it washes up on the beaches. So, yeah, my family had a house in the Cayman Islands, and they had like an acre and a half of private beach. And they would see occasionally. They would see people go by, and they actually some guy actually found, I think it was like $4,000 that had washed up on his beach, dumped by pirates. They were being chased by the Coast Guard right there. So, it's craziness. Sharks aren't eating the money. They're just eating cocaine.
Well, I just want to end this segment by saying, don't go out alone around wildlife. And if you do, be prepared. Be prepared. I'm freaking out about how many attacks on land and sea there are all of a sudden. Part of that, when you read the actual stories and the details, it's the human that made the mistake. Like the last bear attack last week, this lady was a professional. She was in Montana for the summer working. This is what she do. She knew better. She was going on a run in the forest in bear country. Like, I consider where I live bear country. It's not really bear country compared to Montana.
Right.
And Jackson, Wyoming, and places like that.
Right.
She had no business in the forest running around, no spray, no weapon, early morning. Now, you know, yeah, animals. So this is when they're out. This mm-hmm. is when they're out.
Yep. You're asking for it then, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I always carry spray.
So do I. I carry it in places where there are no bears because they're good for other mm-hmm. animals too.
You bet. Mountain lion country. We don't have bears here where I live. No bears. And I still carry bear spray. So just gets the point across. I'm not an easy meal.
Right. So another thing we talked about last week was, I know some people here in live in my neighborhood that worked on for Tesla. And they were telling me to be on the lookout next year for 10 new, brand spanking new electric SUVs. Some of them from companies you've never heard of, don't even exist right now. And some from companies you know, but 10.
10's a lot.
10 new ones. So not rebrands or updates, 10 brand new vehicles mm-hmm. in one segment. That is crazy.
And you said that they're supposed to be SUVs?
SUVs.
SUVs. So my question is, whenever, because, you know, overlanders and off-roaders and, you know, people like myself, because I work for Trails Off-Road, you know, I do some trail mapping and things like that. There's typically not a charging station at the beginning of a trail for me or at the end. So I just kind of wonder where they're going to get their power. Is there going to be some new solar technology that goes into these, you know, these new rigs? Because I'm all for it. I think it's great. As long as it gets me to where I want to go.
Well, you read my mind, because I also mentioned that when they were telling me all of this, my reply to them was, so when is the tech coming?
Right.
And I mentioned range and infrastructure, and they casually mentioned to me, they were like, oh, it's on the way. And I don't know if he was just saying that in general or he knew something, but the next day in the news, 7 automakers united to create a leading high-powered charging network across America. Mm-hmm. And the companies are the BMW Group, General Motors, Honda, Hyundai, Kia, Mercedes-Benz, and Stellantis. And before we get into this, I want to break this down and explain how big a deal this is.
Okay.
First of all, it's 7 major automakers. So that makes it huge.
Mm-hmm.
But when you break down the BMW Group, that's not just BMWs.
No.
That's motorcycles. That's their other vehicles that they make. General Motors. We always look at General Motors as like one car company, but that's mm-hmm. Cadillac. That's GMC. That's Chevy. Yep. That's a lot of vehicles. That is a huge chunk. Same mm-hmm. thing with Stellantis. That's more than one car company. So my point is, the 7 that chose to work together, that's a big, powerful group. That is a large amount of the vehicles on the road.
Right.
And they've gotten together, and their target is to install at least 30,000 high-powered charge points in urban and highway locations. So I guess they are going to do something about it. What do you think?
So it's not just... Because I've done a lot of research into the hybrid world, the electric vehicles, things like that. Because like I said, I'm all for it. I think it's a great idea. There are questions that I have, though, outside of even range. Because whenever you go into some of these electric vehicles and you look for, where am I going to put my stuff? Where is my storage going to go? Here we are, we're these overlanders, nomads, you know, living this lifestyle. Where are we going to put our stuff? you look underneath the seats and that's where the batteries are going. The batteries are going underneath these seats. Well, guess where we get our storage from? We pull out the seats to get the storage underneath and put in these platforms. Okay, well, we can't do that anymore now. There are certain companies out there that have taken all that storage. Now we don't have, well, now we have less, you know, space to put things. So we have choices to make. We either carry less stuff or they have to, you know, come up with more compact, better functioning storage. I don't know what they're going to do with that. I don't like to put a lot of things on my roof, maybe a rooftop tent, but some people, you know, they stack things really, really high. That interferes with your range. You know, as far as how far your distance, because there's a lot more wind resistance or you're using more power, you know, there's a lot, it all goes hand in hand. But my question then, you know, is are the batteries going to get smaller? You know, because I think that the technology for the batteries, that all, you know, that all needs to come together. So those are some of my concerns. You know, there's charging station availability. There's also battery sizes. Where are they going to put the batteries? Because otherwise we have to give up storage space. We're giving up a lot of storage space.
So I got a question. Mm-hmm. Did someone bring that up to you, or was that your first thought? Was that your thought about the storage?
Those are my thoughts because okay, I looked at a lot of these vehicles. And so I'm like, okay, well, let's look underneath the seat and what's there? Batteries. Where am I going to put my stuff?
The reason I asked you that is, and before I even say that.
Yeah.
What just happened now is the reason I created this podcast.
Okay.
Through conversation, through debate, through analysis of the news. I think you provide a lot of information. And this is one of those things. July 31st, you get credit for this because somebody will hear it. They'll say it and they won't. And they'll say it like it was their thought.
Okay.
You're the first person, and you know I talk to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
You're the first person who said something about the batteries under the seat, the lack of storage, the removal of the seats. I've not heard anybody say that.
Okay.
And it's a very good point. Anybody who's built one rig knows how big a deal. That's a lot of space. That has mm-hmm. a lot to do with the configuration of your vehicle. That's a huge point. You made a good point. I want to make sure you get credit for it. I want to be able to... when I hear somebody else be able to play it. No, Candy. That's all.
Thank you.
But it's simple, but that's a big deal if you're talking about overlanding. Space mm-hmm. is always like the issue.
Mm-hmm.
If you, no matter what your priorities are, water, refrigeration, whatever it is, it still boils down to, can I fit it in here?
Mm-hmm.
Excellent point. I'm still in that, and I'm not going to mention you.
Okay. I'll forgive you.
Staying on the electric vehicles, are you familiar with the NEIS Grenadier?
I have. I've seen it. I saw it at Overland Expo East last year. Kicked the tires sufficiently. It looks like the love child of a Rover and a Land Cruiser.
I agree with that.
I thought it was cool.
Well, since you mentioned that, just a little trivia, the owner of the company is a billionaire named Jim Ratcliffe or something like that.
Okay.
Give me a second. I'm pretty sure his name is Jim Ratcliffe. Anyway, what he says is the whole reason why he came up with the concept of this vehicle is his unhappiness with his Land Rovers. He was a Land Rover guy.
Okay.
So in an interview, he stated specifically that he was trying to build a better Land Rover. So it's not by happenstance that the vehicle looks the way you described.
Mm-hmm.
He was absolutely going for that look. If he heard you say that, he'd probably be like, yes.
He can send me one and I will leave him my address after the podcast. I will take it. I will build it out and then I will have it everywhere. Everyone will see it.
So the reason I brought up the vehicle was because they just hit the news again. They just completed another tier of their testing and they've finally concluded what the range is for the vehicle, which is 249 miles.
And that's some gas?
Oh, no, no, no. That's the electric one. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
Oh, God, that would be horrible.
Right? I was like, man, it's big. I didn't think it was that big.
Yeah, 204. They didn't even hit 250. Golly.
But that's just straight electrical, though. I mean, that's better than the Jeep gets right now. Just on straight electric.
I'm not comparing. I think they all suck when it comes to range.
You're right. You're right about that.
And I mean, nobody's even in the ballpark for me to even consider at this point.
No.
Do you have like a number they need to hit? Mine might be too outrageous.
Well, to be reasonable. So I think that it needs to have at least a 300 mile range, a solid 300 mile range, and then quick recharge, because I don't want to be sitting somewhere for 40 minutes waiting for this thing to recharge again. I want to be able to pull up just like I do at a gas pump, be in and out in 10 minutes and be on my way. So they have to do quick recharge and it has to be able to hit 300 miles at a time. That's my deal.
The only difference I have is range.
Mm-hmm.
500.
And that's good range.
The reason why that's my number is because I still think that the charging stations, no matter how many of them they have, there's going to be issues like with the chargers being available as there's more vehicles. You know, you pull up in a station and there's cars in line.
Yep.
Then when you finally get hooked up the time and things mm-hmm. like that. So I would like to be able to do what I do in my internal combustion vehicle. Mm-hmm. I see a crowd at the gas station. Oh, I still got some gas. I'll go to the next gas station.
Yeah.
I need 500 miles. I don't want to be so tethered to the pump that I have to stay. I have to wait. I have to go to that gas station. It takes away any kind of spontaneity in the trip. I am being dictated by charging stations.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And
what do they do if you run out of power? They can't just show up with a AAA can't just show up with a can of gas and fill you up. I mean, how do they do that? How do they deal with that?
And I'm wondering, like, I've had a vehicle towed off the trail before, and I've experienced other people getting towed off the trail. And depending upon where you are and what trail, that can easily be $1,000-$2,000 tow.
Yep.
Part of that is because of the remoteness. Mm-hmm. Part of that is because of the ruggedness of where you are. And the third is because generally they're going to pick up a very heavy vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the electric vehicle is going to be twice as heavy. And most of the electric vehicles, the people I know who have them, their insurance is through the car company.
Huh, really?
Yeah. So are they even going to come get you off of a dirt trail? Because
that's an excellent question.
Like my insurance company, I don't even want to mention their name because they've gotten me off of trails where they didn't come get other people.
Okay.
And I don't know if they were supposed to do it or not, but they've been working out for me. I'll tell you offline.
Okay.
But it's like a 50-50 chance when you're on a trail whether your insurance is going to come get you off of a trail. And I'm thinking it's even lower for these electric vehicles.
Yeah, that the weight is something too that I've heard some stuff about too. There's a new truck out. It's a full-size truck, and you know, To be honest, I don't know how much more it weighs than the one I've got in my driveway right now. They're saying, you know, it weighs up to 6,500 pounds on it. That's not, you know, lifted or anything like that. I don't know as far as the weight goes with the batteries and stuff like that. Can I mention the truck that I'm comparing to? I'm talking about the Ford Lightning. The Ford Lightning that's out is about 6,500 pounds. I have a Ram 1500, you know, with a Hemi in it that's the same weight. So if I had to become picked up off the trail, the weight, I mean, it's the same. It's irrelevant. So, and that's without any gear, of course. But I don't know that it's going to weigh that much more, to be perfectly honest. That's the big question, is does it really weigh more? I don't know. But I know what I have in my driveway compared to what's being sold right now, you know, comparing full-size truck to a full-size truck, they weigh the same.
And I don't think it would vary that much from vehicle to vehicle.
Right.
No more than maybe 500 pounds.
I agree with you.
So.
Yeah.
Well, this Ineos Grenadier, like I said, they tested the electric version. They've come up with 249 mile range, but okay, alongside of it, they also were testing the they have a hydrogen version, a fuel cell electric, they call them fuel cell electric vehicles.
Interesting.
Powered by hydrogen.
Okay.
And without knowing much about hydrogen fuel, what's your thought when you hear that news?
I think of the Hindenburg. That's what I think of. I don't know why this is such a great idea, to be honest. I mean, am I wrong?
Yes, you are right.
Okay.
So I just wanted to mention that they were testing the hydrogen cell, but I will cover a few of the pros and the cons. Some of them have to do with where they are technologically.
Okay.
One of the main goals is, I mean, pros is there's no vehicle emissions. There's nothing. It gives off no vehicle emissions. Another pro is hydrogen is abundant. If there's an infrastructure put in place, it's very easy to produce. Land. You don't need a lot of land. With everything else, you need land, whether it's you are mining for elements for batteries, mm-hmm. whether you are digging and drilling for oil. All the other ones actually require a lot of land use.
Okay.
It requires the just a factory. For hydrogen. Now, the cons are it's expensive. And like I said, a lot of the cons have something to do with it's not really out there yet and there's no infrastructure. So maybe that would go away if they went to the technology. But right now, the technology is extremely expensive. And in order for you to go any major distances in a vehicle, it would require extremely high pressure and it would require, obviously, onboard storage. So I didn't even think about this until you mentioned before about I don't want to give up no storage.
We carry a lot of stuff, man.
And the solution is they can compress the hydrogen to a certain extent, but it would still need extra storage. But even if they were able to get it down to nothing, the more they compress it, the more volatile it is.
Nah.
So like you were saying, you're driving around in the damn Hindenburg.
Right. Yeah. So I have to ask then, what's the mileage range you're looking at on a full tank of hydrogen?
I don't have a number for you, but okay. I do know the formula that they have basically for it. It's twice that of gas.
Okay. So more like a Prius range. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Let me see if I can pull up something about that.
I just don't know a lot about hydrogen.
It took me too long to find the info, but I know the basic formula is it's no less than twice the amount.
Okay. So that's pretty good.
And if done properly, it can easily be 3 times, 4 times, 5 times. But again, the more range you got, the more space is needed.
Mm-hmm. And it's a bomb.
Yeah.
I mean,
I don't want to drive around with hydrogen.
It wouldn't be my first choice. I'm more on board with the electric vehicles if I have to choose, you know, something outside of gas.
Okay, the next thing I want to talk about is car loans, and I want to read this so I can get it right.
Okay.
The Federal Reserve found the overall rejection rate for auto loans was 14.2% in June, the highest level since the Fed started collecting this kind of data. So just in general first, what do you think? Well, no, let me give you some more information. Let me give you so we're on even. I'm gonna give you all the info I have.
Okay.
Car loans are tougher to get. More people are getting rejected by lenders, and lenders are tightening the purse strings as inventory improves on car lots. And there's a recent increase in delinquencies and defaults.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think is going on?
What do I think is going on? I feel really bad for people who actually need a car loan and need a car just to get to work, to and from work, because they're paying so much out of pocket just in just on their loan. They're never going to pay that car off. How are you going to do that with rates that high? I really feel for people who are in that position. I really don't know how people are going to survive. You know, how do you pay a car payment that is the equivalent of a home mortgage at this point? You know, because that's in addition to the vehicles being very, very expensive. Now you're having to pay a 14% loan on top of that. That's a lot. I mean, maybe I'm just old and thought, you know, when paying a $600, you know, a month deal was really expensive for a vehicle payment. Now you're talking about $1,500. Then that's, you know, kind of average at this
average,
point.
Yeah.
That's average at this point. I have a hard time with that.
So do I.
It makes used cars more attractive to me. It makes fixing and repairing what I have more attractive to me, as opposed to taking on a new car payment. All my vehicles are used. I mean, used by me. I bought them, you know, new, but they're really, really old now, and they're all over 100,000 miles. And if it breaks, we just fix it. That's where it's at, because it's cheaper than the car payment that we're looking at for a brand new vehicle.
So my strategy for a couple of decades now has been 0% financing. I wait till 0% financing.
Yep, us but too.
What is happening is rugged vehicles that you would actually want to use to go travel and do overlanding in never get 0% financing anymore. So that little trick is gone out the window for me. I used to just wait for 0% financing, but that don't come around for vehicles that you really want anymore.
Yeah,
even
that's
if I
why
have I the cash, I hold on to the cash and get to 0% financing. That was my whole little game.
Yep. We did the same game. We played the same game because it was smart. That was how you got the most out of your money and stretched your dollar the most. So
here's my opinion about the car loan delinquency. First of all, the economy is terrible.
Yes.
So there are some people, they ain't got a job. They can't pay for it. Nope. You got some people, they got bills and they got to pick one, which ones to pay, and they ain't paying their car loan. Mm-mm. So that's one segment. And I feel sorry for them. There needs to be a solution for that. I'm not going to get into whatever the solution should be. Mm-hmm. But this is what I've been saying for over a year now, I feel, that's coming to roost. I've been saying for a while now that these people with the Sprinter vans and stuff, like, because these are all auto loans too. Sprinter vans, yep. RVs, and all of these. I believe that there's delinquency across the board, but if I believe if you were to look at it on a graph in percentages, I would say the percentage of RV owners, Sprinter van owners, expensive trucks are the highest percentage of people being delinquent.
Okay.
And of those, of that crew, let's just go with Sprinter vans, for example. You can break that down into segments. There are people who literally bought a Sprinter van as an economic decision.
Mm-hmm.
Some people were about to lose their home.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, well, I can sell my home, get a little, get enough to put a down payment on this truck, and I'll have enough to make payments for a year, 6 months, or whatever number they came up with. And the time is run out. They either thought they were going to be a YouTube or Instagram star, or they were going to get all these sponsors, and the sponsors were going to pay for their life. So I believe that's a major part of what's coming home to roost.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I think it is. It is the economy. But it's a lot of people who made this as a business move or as an economic move, and they didn't think it out that well.
Well, they think that it's cheaper to that because you're living in your car, basically, that it's going to be a cheaper way to live. It's a cheaper lifestyle. It is not. You pay a lot for gas. You pay a lot for insurance. You pay for, you know, there's a lot of money that goes into living on the road that people underestimate. I know whenever we were, because we lived a year and a half, we had a we had our Toyota Tundra TRD that we had and that we were towing our Bigfoot with, because we had a Bigfoot RV and we lived in that for a year and a half. And let me break it down to you. It is not less expensive to live just on the road. Whenever we were plugged into power and we had to pay for any of that utilities, it was triple what it would be in a house because there's no insulation. We had a four season RV, okay? And the insulation was not good enough in there to hold any climate control whatsoever, be it heat or air conditioning. You would pay a whole lot more money for it because it was constantly running. The power was just always on, always, always, always. So we would end up with like a $600, you know, a month bill, as opposed to like a $300 a month bill in a home or an apartment, just because there's that lack of insulation in there. That's why you see, you know, those little skirts and stuff around the base of the RV sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's to help insulate a little bit better at the base there, so that you don't pay quite as much. But no, it's not cheaper. I'm here to tell you, it's not. We did it for a year and a half and it is not less expensive.
And we know a very good recent example of why that's not a good strategy. We know a couple, won't mention their name, but we know a couple who decided to go full time.
Yes.
And in less than a year, they reported back, oh, they hate this.
Mm-hmm.
And they spent a lot of time in air nabs and formal campgrounds and different things like that. They had to come up with Wi-Fi solutions and different things. Mm-hmm. And when you add those things up, it ends up being more expensive than when what they were paying for their rent.
Mm-hmm. Or their mortgage. It's not sustainable. It's not a sustainable lifestyle whenever you're doing the Airbnbs and things like that, like you're talking about.
Because what I'm finding out from talking to lots of people is a majority of your nomads take breaks. They have days where they they go to a hotel or they go to a formal campground so they can plug up and charge everything back up or to conduct business or get Wi-Fi. And most people, when they go this route, they're like, oh, I'm going to just live in this van or this truck 24/7. And some people do. We know people who do. But most of them don't. And there was no budgeting for that. And I believe COVID is coming to rest. I mean, to roost. There were people who got a lump sum of money, enough to maybe a down payment and to get through a year of payments or whatever. And now they're in a situation. There are some people who thought they knew what the budget was for living on the road. They had a nice chunk of change in the bank, but they went right through it because they had an incident with the vehicle. They repairs, updates, upgrades, health. Maybe they have health insurance, but you still, you know, you have a deductible. And depending upon what happened, that deductible might be huge. And I could just go on and on where I have talked to people that are in dire straits. And it basically came down to they did not think about all of the costs that possibly could come up. The, none of them. They just had this great whimsical idea in their mind. I'll travel around and I'll post on Instagram. And
that'd
I'll
be great.
Yeah.
It'll be great. It can be great, but you definitely need to be aware, like you say, of budgeting. And I think a lot of people don't know how to budget, especially, you know, I don't know, like you said, mechanical issues and things like that come up. And, you know, you do have to have a little fund set aside for things like that. I mean, we even have that for our house. You know, we have a, you know, a little bit set aside for if something happens to your house. It's not different. It's just, you know, it's the same structure. You just have to apply it to in a different way. So it goes into your vehicle or whatever it is instead. And then, so I know somebody right now who, you know, this person as well, not going to mention names, but this person is stranded where they're at because they had a catastrophic failure on their vehicle and they've been stranded in one location, which has not been pleasant for this person for over a month. Over
exactly who you're talking
a month.
About.
Yes. Yes. And that was something that was not, you know, it wasn't planned. It was not a part of this person's plan to have to endure this. And it's been very hot. It's been, you know, very, you know, the weather's been just unforgiving and the heat and the wind and all of this stuff. And this person lives full time, you know, out of their vehicle. And it's not going, you know, really well for them emotionally, I don't think. And I could see that would be very, very, very stressful for anyone. But yeah.
And remember last year when we were at East, again, we won't mention the name, but somebody we both know was surprised to discover they didn't have any kind of health insurance. And they were having a major situation that most people would have immediately been like, hey, I got to go to the doctor. And they literally had to just suffer through it. I don't want to get into what it was because that might, you know, give up. But you know what I'm talking about, right?
And I do.
That's a hell of a thing that you got to just bite the bullet on a major thing that you should be in a hospital about. And possibly had been getting medical care up until that point, and maybe it wouldn't have even happened.
Yeah. I think it's a shame whenever, you know, people take off and think about, you know, pursuing the dream and living the dream and it becomes a nightmare. But I think for the majority of folks, that is the reality. That becomes the reality. So.
But I'm leading up to, if you don't listen to nothing me and Candy talking about today, and if you ain't going to focus on the rig, if you're not going to focus on any of the stuff we talked about, being safe in the woods, away from animals, have some kind of insurance. Have some kind of health insurance. We know a family that's traveling around the world with no insurance.
having been parents, we know that that is quite the gutsy move.
I'm not going to get into it, but my daughter would be dead if it were not for good health insurance. Mm-hmm. It's that simple. Mm-hmm. It is that simple. And I understand the psychology. I remember when I was young and working, you know how you could choose to decide to have insurance or not. And I used to not get it because I'd save a couple of $100 a month. I don't even think it was a couple of $100 a month. It was some, I wasn't even really saving no money. It was stupid. But I understand the mentality, like, I'm fine, she's fine, the kids are fine, or whoever, we're all in good health.
Yep.
But it can turn
until you're not.
Right. It can turn on a corner. And especially you're traveling.
Yes.
You know, you can come in contact with situations that you normally wouldn't even come in contact with.
Whether like it's a bear.
A bear, an accident, all types of stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of risk involved with traveling full time, especially whenever you have other factors like, you know, kids.
I know somebody who did the Pan Am a couple of years ago, and they didn't complete it because they got meningitis.
Oh, no.
Yep.
That's new. That's a new one. I haven't heard of that one before.
Removed from the wrist. Had to remove the hand, to the elbow on this arm. Both legs are gone.
What?
It happened like boom, 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 boom. And he was a very healthy gentleman. Very healthy guy. Very healthy guy. And we've talked. He probably would not have had that situation occur if he hadn't have been on this trip. So my point is, you're literally at more risk than if you were at home. So please don't be traveling around without no insurance. Please.
Right.
I see some people driving around in $100,000 rigs with another $50,000 worth of stuff in it. And they ain't got no insurance.
Mm-mm.
That is crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it is.
So what's the next thing you're going to be doing itinerary-wise? Do you have an event coming up?
We do have an event coming up. I'm going to be teaching at Overland Expo Mountain West coming up in Colorado. I'm not sure exactly what my schedule is yet, but I've already got my tickets, and they'll let me know what I'm teaching when I get there.
Well, I'll definitely be seeing you there. Hopefully we'll get to hang out before the event starts.
That would be fun.
I got a question. Have you ever been to the Mid-Atlantic Overland Festival in Pennsylvania?
Nope.
It's occurring same month. I think maybe even the same weekend. So I just want to announce that August 10th through 13th. No, that's not the same weekend. It's a couple of weekends before. The Mid-Atlantic Overland Festival is August 10th through 13th in Huntington County, Central Pennsylvania. I've been invited to it a few times, but it is always conflicted with other things that I have going on. I was just wondering, had you been to it and did you have something to say about it?
No, and I'm going to be honest, the only event that I had ever been to, my first one was Overland Expo West. Okay. And that was in 2018. That was my very first one. And, you know, it just kind of.
What made you go to the first one?
I was taking my trip to Alaska, and it happened to be the weekend that it wrapped up was the week that I left for Alaska, actually. So I went to this and I thought that would be the best place to get the last minute information that I was looking for that I couldn't find, you know, because back then, you know, yeah, we have the World Wide Web and the internet and all that stuff, but the information wasn't as readily available, believe it or not, as it is now. So I decided that I was going to go to West, and because it just lined up with my travel plans, and I met up with a group there, and you know, got all the information that I needed, and I enjoyed it so much. And I got such great information that I decided that, you know, applying as an instructor was a way that I could give back. That's the reason why I applied to be an instructor to begin with, because I did get so much out of that experience that I had. So
what classes have you taught so far?
Collectively? Mm-hmm. Okay. I've taught Alaska, Canada. I was on the Baja panels recently whenever I did Baja. The US West, Route 66, Traveling with Pets, Furry Friends. What in the world else? I've taught a lot of classes. I mean, just at Pacific Northwest, they had, I was in nine classes for the whole weekend I was teaching. I was very busy. But I like to be busy. So I would never complain about that. I like being busy.
So backtrack, because like I said, you were busy. Mm-hmm. You're an insider. I'm on the outside looking in.
Okay.
It looked like, in general, the classes were fuller and it looked like the tents were bigger. Is that accurate?
I think the tents are the same size. The turnout sizes were very generous this show. But this show is a different show. And I think we've had this discussion before about it, about being at Pacific, being at in Bend, this location here. The people who are there to learn, I think, a lot more. So they show up and they're looking for information. They're looking the way that I was whenever I first showed up at West, I think. That's the impression that I get. They're not just there to like hang out and do things. They're specifically there with a task in mind. You know, they're looking for specific classes and things. They don't just wander in typically. That's not what I find, is that they, I was just, you know, just heard you talking and thought I'd wander in. Didn't find a lot of that there. People who are there, the classes are very full, because the people are there to learn, and they look at the schedule and they seek you out. So, I actually had people emailing me after my classes looking for additional information. So, yeah.
Now, one thing I don't have to ask, because I saw it with my own eyes, is it seemed like there was a lot more engagement. Instructors weren't able to just say, all right, I'll see you later. There was like a line of people waiting to talk to instructors in each of these classes. I actually even witnessed it with you in particular. Nobody left after the class. They were waiting for their turn to talk to you.
Yeah, we're busy after the fact. I think that's why they give us the buffer a little bit, so they can get in between classes and we can get in between classes, but they can also get, you know, some personal, you know, one-on-one information if they have very specific questions. So like I said, I even get emails after the classes, which is, you know, which I always appreciate too, because people are just, they're very engaged.
And what I have noticed is, and you're an example, you were just telling the story about yourself. I've seen people just show up to an expo and then they're at another one, then they're an instructor, or they're in media, or they go on a trip and come back, or they get more and more involved. They don't get less and less involved.
Yeah, for me, it was just my way to give back and kind of fill in the gaps that I found. Because like I said, I didn't find a whole lot of information about the trip I was going on whenever I was doing the Arctic Circle and all through Canada. And there were certain highways that I learned about whenever I was at specifically the round table it was really cool for me to be an attendee and be in the audience of the Alaska Canada round table, and then be able to come back and participate in that after the fact. That was super cool for me. It was kind of full circle.
I think I have a good question. Maybe it's not, but.
Okay.
Like, there are round tables for like, let's say Alaska. Mm-hmm. And then there are like classes for Alaska.
Yes. I teach both of those.
Right. What would be the differences? What would I be looking? Why would I go to one versus the other? I think you should go to both because you're going to get something from each and it's going to be different. But I want you to give that differentiation, please.
So the way that I've taught the round table that I'm on is Alaska and Canada. So it's for people who are maybe traveling, you know, up through the Alaska Highway and into, through Canada and into Alaska itself. Then there is a more specific class just about Canada itself, and that can cover the entire country. So it's not just the Alaska Highway portion of it or the Cassia Highway on the West Coast. It incorporates the entire country at that point. So you're talking East Coast, West Coast, and all the Maritimes as well. Then there is a separate class now that they've offered since they started these bivvies, which is more like hanging out and chilling in your living room with someone, just having a cup of coffee, hanging out and just talking about it. I really like those casual settings too. And people can just get, you know, a lot more one-on-one time. So there's a lot of very personal time in the bivvies, which I've really appreciated that. And I think a lot of people do too, who, you know, they just show up and they're like, hey, how's it going? And the interaction is just really cool and relaxed, and it's not quite as formal. But if you go, so what I like to tell people, if they're in my Canada class, let's start generally. So they start at the round table and they go, okay, you get several different perspectives on one single location at this round table from say five people, which is awesome. Then one of those five people goes off and is teaching a more formal class on the country. So you come to that class too for additional information. Then you have more questions and you're like, okay, this person who's teaching, I'm really learning a lot, but I have other questions and I would really like to pick their brain more. Then you go to the bivvy. So that, for me, that's the transition that I like to see, because then if all you want to know is about Canada, you can get it all from there.
Okay.
Did any of that make any sense?
No, it made a lot of sense. Okay. I already understood. I want the listeners to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
You listen to the podcast, you know there's pretty much two things that I push: social and education.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to highlight that there's different levels, there's different types of learning. People learn differently. People intake knowledge differently. And I just wanted to highlight that there's different formats of some of the same information.
So in my formal class, mm-hmm. I do, there's a common, I come in and I put a map up on the wall of the country of Canada so that people have a visual. So if you're more of a visual learner, like you say, people learn differently, then take the class, because there is video, there's photo, as well as mapping up there, where you don't get that at the round tables necessarily, and you don't get that necessarily in the bivvy. Although I will tell you, I personally bring in a little map, so that whenever people will say, oh, well, I wish I had a map with me so that I could ask you about XYZ. Well, here's a map. Tell me what you want to know. And I will get, you know, I will break it down for you like this. But in the formal class, that's where I actually have photo, video, and a really big map up on the wall where people come up and they actually take photographs. They'll take photographs of my photographs on the TV. So for very visual learners, I would recommend the formal class. Absolutely. If you want a more chill atmosphere and you want more one-on-one time about it, I recommend the bivvies. And I also recommend the round tables as well, because then you actually get that perspective from other people as well about the same subject.
I kind of get something different from both. Like when you guys are just talking as a group in one of the bivvies, things come up that mm-hmm. don't come up in a more formal situation. People mm-hmm. will ask a question, or the instructor will mention a little piece of trivia about their trip and it lights a light bulb in you, or induces a question that you didn't have that now you have. And now that mm-hmm. you get the information, it's like gold. So I enjoy both because I get something totally, completely different from them.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like when you walk through a vendor section of it, of an event, and you look at the vehicles and the bills, you learn stuff about bills and vehicles. But then you go out to camp area and it's a whole different thing, and you learn other things. So I kind of look at it that way.
Because it's a less formal setting, and you're not wrong. That's a great comparison. It's definitely in both situations that we're talking about, it's a less formal setting. So it's more relaxed, and just people feel more comfortable talking about things, and they don't feel singled out, I think, too. And we're just kind of all at the same level. We're just chilling out in these comfy chairs, you know, drinking water and stuff, and, you know, just kind of hanging out, like I said, in my living room, you know, because that's how I describe it. I'm like, come on in, have a seat in my living room. Let's have a talk.
So have you decided whether or not you're going to Overland Expo West? I'm sorry, East?
I can't, because that is the weekend that my build is getting complete. The most critical part of my new build is getting done that weekend. Otherwise, I would absolutely be there. So that's why it's kind of up in the air, is whether or not I'm able to go to Moon Landing. Is if whenever my build gets home, that'll determine whether or not I can go. Fortunately, I can make it in a day. It's a day's drive. So that's where my thoughts are at. That's where my hopes are at. I'm hoping for Moon Landing for kind of my final event of the year. Otherwise, we'll see. We'll see.
So I'm curious, if you go to the Moon Landing and you have time, what would be your route?
If I have time heading to Moon Landing from where I'm coming from? Well, okay. So the fastest way to get there is obviously the 40. If I were to break it down into a couple of days, instead of just going straight through, I would probably stay somewhere in the Flagstaff area, in the forest there. I like that area. Lots of free camping there. There's also a place I like to hang out just around New Mexico, is Cibola National Forest, is a really great spot for additional camping there. And it's just right outside that spot. So if you get there maybe a day ahead of time, and you have a day where you want to just hang out and chill before you go to the event, or even immediately after, it's right there. Cibola is great. It's at elevation. So, you know, bring your winter socks with you, because you're at about 7,000 to 8,000 feet at that time of year, because that's October. But in the summer, that's my summer escape whenever I'm going cross country, is Cibola. So
no matter what, I think I'm going to go through Moab and do at least one trail. Because if I don't, this will be the first year in I don't know how many years, but a lot of years, that I have not been to Moab.
Oh, okay.
So I'm kind of like going to cheat and I got to go through Moab and do at least one trail. It ain't going to be no hard trail or nothing. Mm-mm. Just to keep the record going.
Moab's great. I love Moab.
I have a love-hate relationship with Moab. Because I love it because it's beautiful. So many trails and close proximity. Like if you really into knocking off trails, you can do like 3 trails a day. If you want to relax a little bit, 2 trails a day, you can knock off a lot of trails. The thing I don't like about Moab, I have to share it.
Yes, the crowds. I was going to say the crowds. Did you get your Utah card yet? Your off-road card done?
I don't even know what you're talking about.
So there's a card that you have to do now in order to go off-roading in the Utah area, and you get a little card afterwards.
Forgot about that.
I
need to write that down. I need to do that after I get off of here. Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, I did mine the week it came out, because I was waiting. I was perched and waiting. Well, because I do a lot of trail mapping out there too. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to make sure I have my card done. So just make sure you have it done before you head back into Moab.
I am so glad you mentioned that. Another reason why I have a love-hate with Moab.
Yeah.
I remember when the 191 going right through it was the only paved road. you turn off those roads and they'd be dirt roads and everything.
Yeah.
On the off season, Main Street is like packed still. And I remember the main season used to be April to September. I mean, and I mean like the first week of September. So my game plan used to be September and October.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now it's extended. People are there all the way to November or to when it, till they have a first snow.
It seems busy a lot of the time there. So I really like, you know, I really enjoyed EJS because, you know, Jeep girl in the house. And actually, that's where I've met a few people actually is out at Easter Jeep Safari, just randomly. And we're still friends to this day. But yeah, my very favorite trail out there, Schneebly Hill Road. That was.
The people beautiful. Laugh at me. Why do you like it? That's mine too. But why do you like it? Because people make fun of me. I'll get into that later.
Views, and more views. Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. I love it for the views coming down that steep switchback down the face of that rock, the horseshoe bend that's down there. That's not the horseshoe bend. And I don't have to pay $10 for parking. I like being able to stop and have lunch. And, you know, whenever I go on there, I don't hardly ever see anybody. I mean, Moab is noted for their, you know, the big slick rock trails, which are great. Those are great. But then there's also some of these other ones like Schneebly Hill, which is, you know, part of a national park system too, which is, you know, pretty incredible. So I don't know. I love it for its views and I'm all about it. And I love mountain trails too. So whenever you get up in some of that hairy stuff, I dig it.
So it's my favorite trail. Okay. And it's the one I usually almost always recommend to people who are either newbies or a person is like, I've only got one day in Moab. And first, I look at the ratio of difficulty versus eye candy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think out of all the trails in the whole Moab,
mm-hmm.
the amount of difficulty and how much eye candy you get is the highest of any of them.
Two thumbs way up.
Because that's probably the one trail I'm going to do when I do Moab.
Yeah.
And it's because, like, I don't even have to really be going to Moab. Mm-mm. I could be going to, like, New Mexico.
Just right.
Going through. Well, I can stop. And I can zip through in 3 hours through there, get back on the 191 and go to New Mexico.
Right.
So extremely easy trail, but the payoffs, golly.
Huge.
Mm-hmm.
Huge payoffs. I love it. It's my favorite too. Then it's off to that little, the quesadilla truck for lunch.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yes, you do, food guy.
Is that your favorite place to eat in Moab?
The quesadilla truck in Moab? Yeah, it is. Sincerely, it is. They got the little patio out there and everything.
My favorite is not because of food. Mine is the Moab Diner.
Okay.
And it's because I've gone in there a lot of times. I'm making up a number now just to make my point. Let's say I went there 10 times. 8 of those times I saw somebody either very famous or like a bunch of guys from a manufacturer with a vehicle they're testing. I always see something exciting when I go there.
Okay.
The parking lot will like have experimental vehicles in it. Then just regular folks, you know, you'll see somebody you see on TV. You'll see somebody, making a TV show. You'll see somebody. I've just had like some remarkable interactions at the Moab Diner. It's probably never going to happen again now, but
I'll show up there and I'll be like, all right, Phil, where are these famous people at? I see no one.
But you know, a lot of the manufacturers like to test their vehicles in Moab.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, that's their favorite spot to eat.
Okay. Well, I'll have to check it out. Thanks for telling me about it.
And I like to get a shake from the, I forget the name of the other one. It's called the Moab something. It's the one that looks like a 60s diner.
Okay.
That's closer to the street. You know what I'm talking about.
I probably do.
White building with red. And I think they have the best shakes. And then further down the street, you know, I'm always turn it into food. There's a Mexican place. It's a chain, but it's only one of them in Moab. I can't think of the name of it, but it's a Mexican restaurant. It's open like 24 hours. It's the only restaurant open 24 hours in Moab.
I'm sure they're busy.
You're almost driving out of it going south.
Okay.
Anyway, I'm reminiscing. Is there anything else you want to talk about? Is there anything you want to announce? Is there anything you want to say?
At the moment, no, I'm good. I'm just kind of getting ready for, like I said, my next classes and trying to decide what direction I'm going to take and what little adventure I'm going to end up on between home and Mountain West. I've got a few things in my mind, you know, kind of bucket list types of things, but haven't firmed up any plans yet. And that probably won't happen until the very last moment, because that's how I roll. I don't usually make reservations or anything like that. I just decide, well, this is the way we're going. Here we go. And those are dictated by weather. Weather's a big one because she's the boss. Mother Nature's the boss. She's in charge. If it's pouring rain someplace I want to go, well, I'm not going to go there now because that's not going to be any fun. So I'll go the other way. So we'll see what the weather looks like. We'll see how all the plans shake out and go from there. How about you?
I got nothing. I'm getting ready for Overland Expo West.
Mm-hmm.
Talking to different people about my build, mm-hmm. talking to different people about my trip. There's so many things I'm just anxious to divulge, but when you talk about it too early, for some reason they never come through. Mm-hmm. So I'm literally scared to talk about all the exciting things I got planned. I don't want to mess it up.
Right. I hear that. I get it. You're gonna have to get new stickers made.
Everybody's saying that. No.
No?
No.
No.
I don't need new stickers. I'll tell you why offline.
Okay. I've just got a brand new sticker board in my new build where all mm-hmm. my new stickers are going. So it needs to be filled.
Anything you want to say?
No, I'm good to go. Thanks for reaching out and having me on again. It's always a pleasure.
You can be on as often as you want. You're my girl, full of information. Like I'm always telling you, I love your name. Chicks Do It Too, because you're one of those people who actually has a name that they back up, because Candy really does it too. I almost don't like Chicks Do It Too. You know why I'm starting to not like it?
Tell me.
Because it's literally saying like the men do this and I do it too.
Mm-hmm.
But as I get to know you more, you're doing it and a lot of the men are not coming close to what you're doing. So it's not really like chicks should do it too. It should be like all us men do it too. All right, guys, you know what I'm going to say. Stay safe, tread lightly, and hopefully I'll see you here or on a trail soon.
You have been listening to Waypoint Overland's Random Waypoints. Like, subscribe, and stay tuned for more.